When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Danny Wu, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Ben Golliver of the Washington Post and, of course, the book Bubble Ball. And we have a really fun conversation, talk about not only the conference finals, but the series that came before it, what we can take away, what we're expecting moving forward, but also Ben's experience in the room for the NBA draft lottery, in the physical room with the ping pong balls and all that. It's a pretty cool story. And talk a little bit about the offseason that's coming up pretty soon. Lots of fun stuff here. Conversation runs about an hour and is brought to you by betonline.ag. Use that CLNS50 code to get a 50% welcome bonus and tell them it came from us. So hope you enjoy the episode. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure, Danny. It's been far too long, man. How are you?
Doing well, sir. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well. I got to say, it was maybe the wildest logistical week of my writing career over the last 7 days. It was Memphis, then Milwaukee, then Boston, then Chicago for the draft lottery, and then San Francisco with you last night for the Warriors, you know, pretty dominant game one blowout win over Dallas. A lot of really good playoff basketball, a lot of amazing crowds this year after two pandemic years where it always just kind of felt a little bit off. Even last year during the playoffs, I just feel like the NBA is in a great spot. TV ratings have been through the roof, which is always nice to see everybody, appreciating the sport. And I'm just kind of on cloud nine, to be honest. I imagine you feel the same way.
I do. And it's also a fascinating year from the perspective that I was talking about this with Nate at one point, that like I'd have to go back and look to be sure, but I believe only three or four of my top 10 players in the league the last time we did rankings are still in the playoffs. But you don't necessarily feel that absence too much. I think that, yeah, it sucks that Embiid and Jokic, like all four actually of the top MVP vote getters are out, but you have still great players that are leading these teams, and some of them are very young and ascending. You know, what Jason Tatum did in the first half of game one against the Heat, and of course he's had a really nice playoff run on top of that, and Luka, of course, with the Dallas Mavericks. But you also have some really fun ensemble teams, and that's something that I really appreciate. And in a year where there isn't that super team, there isn't those LeBron Heat teams or the best of the Warriors or anything else, ensembles can be pretty dang fun.
Oh, for sure. And I think you've just got some really hard playing teams across the board. I mean, I think these final four teams that advanced to the conference finals, like, all really earned it, and they were all really clicking in their series as they unfolded and got deeper and deeper. I mean, they just kept, you know, picking up their intensity level. Basically, all of them can play defense at a very high level, and you do have the stars on offense. Every single team's got a shining star on offense, whether it's Tatum, Jimmy, Luka, Steph Curry, maybe even throw Jordan Poole into the mix every once in a while. Earlier in the playoffs, I mean, it's a really nice mix of balanced teams that are focused and together, and that's sort of what you're looking for. To me, it's been a natural progression, though, right? I mean, it's sort of like we saw Tatum in the bubble a couple of years ago. He wasn't quite ready for it. You know, we saw Luka go against the Clippers. I mean, just kind of an ultimate martyr ball performance, sort of, the last couple of years, just doing everything he can possibly do, and yet coming up short against a veteran team just loaded with defenders to throw at him. Now it's their moment. You know, I felt like going into last night, it wasn't like Luka was in the shadow of the Warriors, even though the Warriors are this monolith that's won all these championships in the past and have so much more experience, and they have Steph Curry, who's still, probably the biggest name left in these playoffs. But Luka was sort of on equal footing there, and same deal with Tatum when he was able to knock out the Bucks and Giannis in those last couple of games. I think everyone would pretty much agree Giannis is the best player in the sport right now. He showed that consistently against the Celtics, but it wasn't some fluke when Tatum's going crazy down the stretch of these fourth quarters and hitting step back jumpers off one leg and shooting three pointers. Like, both Luka and Tatum have made that natural progression. They're in the mix and they're vying for titles. And that's an age old story in the NBA, but it's nice to see some new faces do it.
It is. And I'm really happy you brought up defense, because I think that's one of the important takeaways of these playoffs so far. And things could have gone differently with a few different, you know, injuries and results. But when you think about the four teams that are left, if you use cleaning the glasses defensive ratings that filters out garbage time, full season, three of the top four teams on defense are in the conference finals. And then the other one is Dallas. And Dallas was one of the best defensive teams once they kind of flipped that switch in January. And so, and some of the other teams that were in this mix, Phoenix got eliminated in game seven. Memphis nearly made it. And if Ja doesn't get hurt, they could very well have been in this conversation as well. And that ties in with something that we had generally been seeing kind of before the bubble and some of the anomalous shooting and everything else, was that defense wins championships, especially if they can be versatile, especially if you have high-end defenders. And you've traveled all over this last week plus, and something that I've noticed, and you've gotten to see a fair amount of it firsthand, defense, high-end talent makes a huge difference. But I've grown really in these playoffs to appreciate, it's also about the lack of weak points, the lack of sore spots, because then you have to do a lot of scheming, a lot of planning to deal with that. And I mean, a lot of these teams that are left, the Celtics, when they're at full strength, are a great example of this. Miami plays very few bad defenders in the rotation as well, are ensemble defenses too.
Well, it's a great point. The teams I would highlight to help further that point would be Milwaukee and Boston in that series. So in Milwaukee, there was glaring weak points with their offense on the wings, right? I mean, you had Grayson Allen, Pat Connaughton, Wesley Matthews. Like, they couldn't hit a shot. They basically contributed nothing offensively. And, you know, that's just a natural instinct as a media analyst, as your fan, to kind of pile on those guys, be like, what's wrong with them? Like, why are they holding everybody back? And you go back and watch how Boston was defending them. They had no room to breathe. I mean, Boston's rotations were so crisp that, like, yeah, look, if you're giving Grayson Allen, you know, 15 feet on a three-pointer and he's missing, like, that's really frustrating. But if every single shot he's taking is contested, and he's not really a great off the dribble player, and when he's going off the dribble, he's running into Al Horford and Boston's bigs, who are smart and savvy and kind of clogging up the lane, and then they're able to defend him without fouling, which I thought Boston, you know, in some key moments of that series, you know, was very physically imposing without getting too rough and getting too sloppy and getting into foul trouble. Like, yeah, those weaker one-dimensional offensive players are going to start to disappear. And so it was a case to me of, like, you know, does Milwaukee's offense have more weak links or Boston's defense? And after seven games, we saw it was Milwaukee's offense. And the other thing on the defensive front, to me, with everybody spreading out so much, and this goes for, you know, Dallas's offense in terms of how they go five out. This goes for Golden State. I mean, they've been playing spread basketball for an awful long time. And Boston as well. I mean, they've got a lot of shooters that they could put in. The defensive aspect to keep up with those spread lineups requires young legs. It requires guys who are in great condition. It requires hugely motivated players. And I think in some cases, the age factor and just the, you know, the ability to survive that marathon is an under-discussed aspect, right? Like, I look at Phoenix. You know, it's easy to just say, well, they mentally crumbled, you know, CP3, he just doesn't have the right mindset to win the playoffs. He's never going to do it. I think he just got tired. I mean, you look at the Brooklyn Nets, they looked pretty tired, even though it was a short series. They didn't really have the legs to run around and chase all those Celtic shooters. And so I don't think it's a huge surprise that a lot of these 30 plus stars either didn't even make the playoffs in the first place, in LeBron's case, but some of these other guys are just getting picked off as we go, just because of the sheer energy that's required to play high level defense when everybody can shoot and everybody can space at this stage of the postseason.
The exception also proves the rule there, and that is tied into Jimmy Butler. Like, Jimmy Butler's performance, especially in that third quarter of game one of the Eastern Conference Finals, was spectacular. Doing it on both ends, had a couple of huge steals and dunks, but he also offensively got to the line, I believe, 10 times. And Jimmy Butler, you know, they have a lot of young legs around him, and Bam, and
yeah.
I mean, PJs are older, but, you know, like, and they can play a rotation with a lot of other guys. Gabe Vincent had a much better game one than he had the later stretch of the series against Philly. And so for Miami, they're doing it in a little bit of a different way, but it does kind of tie in with this story, of course, too, because the defensive intensity and intelligence that they play with is fantastic.
Yeah, they do have some new younger legs they didn't have in the bubble playoffs, you know, a couple of years ago. But I also look at, like, Jimmy and PJ Tucker as being, like, top 1% guys in the NBA for squeezing the absolute most out of their capabilities, right?
Yes.
And, like, that counts for something too. And you know, we're gonna see, like, as this series with the Celtics unfolds. I thought Miami had a very impressive game one. I left game game one, pretty impressed by Boston too. I mean, to be down two starters with Smart and Horford, who are very important starters, right? And still have the Robert Williams thing, doesn't seem like it's completely cleared up. To be up in that game and to be functioning just kind of on the fly on a short turnaround without two main guys, that was, you know, pretty darn impressive from Boston. And so I think as that series unfolds, you're going to be testing PJ Tucker's legs, right? You're going to be testing Jimmy Butler a little bit, you know, from that longevity standpoint. And I do think at times of last year's postseason, we saw PJ just, you know, be more reluctant to shoot, in some cases, just really wayward three-pointers as the series unfolded. Now, it didn't hold Milwaukee back from winning the championship. I mean, he still gave them a lot of really important minutes, but he was at times, to me, exposed a little bit on the offensive end, you know, deeper in the postseason. And we're reaching that time where, like, okay, well, people are trying to snipe off somebody who might give here. Is he a candidate in this series as it gets to, say, games 4, 5, 6 and beyond?
It's definitely a possibility, and something I was thinking about before we recorded, I wanted to flash back to about 2.5 weeks ago and the start of the preceding series. And so, you know, we just had these two game ones with impressive performances by the home team. 2 weeks ago, roughly, when the semifinals started, Milwaukee handily beat Boston, and I started panicking about picking the Celtics in the series, and Golden State had that weird game where Draymond got ejected right before halftime, and they came back and beat Memphis anyway. Miami handled Philly without Embiid. And then Phoenix was dominant in their win over the Dallas Mavericks, and the Mavericks looked flat, and you're like, oh, great, they beat the Jazz, but is that really something? And that only, to me, serves as a reminder of these series are really long, that will have a lot of ebbs and flows, and I'm really happy you brought up Smart and Horford, because Miami played great, especially in that third quarter. It looks like we're going to see some different personnel in game two, not only because Marcus Smart and Al Horford might be back, but because Derek White is out due to personal reasons.
For sure. Well, you know, last night when Steph Curry was asked just sort of about the challenge or, you know, the opportunity, I guess, of reaching the finals and winning another title, and he made the comment, you know, we're super comfortable on this stage, right? Like, we've been here before. I think this is his sixth Western Conference Finals in the past 8 years. And, you know, winning a big game one, as he said, does not necessarily win you the series, right? And I think that level of poise and that experience has really come through for them. And I think from Boston's standpoint as well, there was multiple chances for them to break mentally against Milwaukee and lose that series. And they came through huge game four, Jason Tatum down the stretch. Obviously, they're down 3-2. They win back-to-back elimination games. And so I think that there's a little mix of, okay, well, some of these players now have the experience factor to understand that, like, you know, that whole first to four cliche is a real deal, and like, don't psych yourself out early in a series. But I've also think we've seen some really good coaching and some really good adjustments. I mean, Ime Udoka, for a rookie coach, does not seem like a rookie in the slightest in this postseason. You know, I thought he did a really nice job of trying to wear down Giannis, of even trying to manipulate the referees and the calls at certain points during that series. And then obviously you look around everywhere else, you know, in his bracket, whether it's Spo or Steve Kerr, you've got some great coaches there. And Jason Kidd, I think, has maybe been one of the biggest shocks of all, but like, how they took away Chris Paul, how they were able to limit Devin Booker in that second round series was pretty impressive work by them. So, you know, I think the idea of these, you know, series not being done early, don't overreact to game one is important. And the other factor on that I would go back to is the home court advantage deal. It is such a more vibrant atmosphere. I'm sure you're feeling it at Chase. This year throughout the postseason, where I think Golden State's still undefeated at home.
Yeah.
But, you know, these series swing in a big way when they change venue, going from game two to game three, right? Like, look at the Memphis series when they had the opportunity to be at home and just how rowdy that place got, how good they looked in game five. And I think that's part of it too. Like, you know, guys like Curry or the Celtics or everything else, like, even if they go down 2-0 Boston, I don't think that they're psyched out feeling like we can't win this series. They just watched Philly, who was a much lesser team, win a couple games at home against Miami in games 3 and 4, right? And so I think the power of the crowd here is a major factor that was missing in the bubble and was sort of half missing last year, and now it's really back. I mean, I can go right down the list. I mean, like, the Whoop the Trick you know, experience in Memphis was absolutely insane. I mean, what a pressure cooker. I can't believe Draymond was laughing along during the middle of that. I definitely would have folded if I was in their spot. You go to TD Garden game 7. I mean, they've got fans dressed up in full full hunting camo, trying to end the Bucks season, you know, with all these hunting type puns on their signs. You know, you see Chase Center last night. I mean, the fans were maybe a little bit late to get there because of the early tip, but they were getting excited in that third quarter push when Steph's hitting the tap dance three-pointers and Lucas turning the ball over. And so I think that kind of contributes to the steadiness throughout a series, you know, realizing, like, you know, if you're on the road and you lose game one, like, there's still plenty of time left.
The ultimate example to that to me in the current playoffs is the Dallas Mavericks in the last series, where they got worked in those first two games by the Phoenix Suns, and then they looked amazing in their first two home games, and right. Then it kind of
I wrote them off.
Yeah.
Did you write them off?
I didn't write them off, but I didn't expect the series to be a long one. I thought it was going to be maybe five or something like that. Like, Dallas is good enough that they could have gotten a split and everything else like that. But also, like, Phoenix was, you know, I can't remember exactly when Chris Paul turned 37, but it was right around then. And so it's like they were looking good. The small concerns I had about them, you're like, oh, well, it looks like it's not at least going to be a problem then. And the Warriors had been much more inconsistent. So, like, you're looking at the Warriors and the Grizzlies, like, oh, can either of these teams keep pace with the Suns? And then it's like, oh, well, neither of them has to play them anymore. It was, yeah. And that's how a playoff series can and should move, is that you have these shifts as you mentioned, the home crowds are a lot of fun. And one of my bigger takeaways from the game ones is we got in each of them, and you had very different preceding times to this, but I think in both cases, the third quarter was a model for the home team of, if it's going to go well, this is how it's going to go well. And we can start with the Warriors. That was the best defense I've seen them play in a while. And they had, I mean, the Warriors were an unbelievable defensive team at the beginning of this year. But if we're factoring in the intensity of the playoffs and everything else, this is the best defensive stretch they had played in years. And Andrew Wiggins was fantastic. They were doing some really nice digs off the corner to make life harder on Luka. And their offense was flowing better than in the first half. And so the theory of this Warriors team being able to take it up to another level, being able to go in the way back machine, even without Andre Iguodala and Gary Payton II, to do something to get the Mavericks off rhythm in a way that Phoenix never really did. Like, they're very different defensive teams, though both of them are wonderful. And then get enough offensively through system buckets and through having really good players to get more than they needed to, you know, to get the win.
Yeah, to me, it was just a vintage third quarter push from Golden State. Like, it did feel like the time machine. You know, I went up to the Klay Thompson return game, and the crowd was so excited for that. And, you know, he actually, like, played beyond my expectations in that game. I mean, obviously, he was, like, running on pure adrenaline. And that was the first moment where I was actually, like, thinking to myself, wow, I know Golden State's had a really good record. I know they've got Steph. I know they've got Draymond. But, like, this does feel like a team that could definitely win the title this year. And I would not want to have to go to Chase and play these guys in the playoffs, because they're just so comfortable and they're just so used to those kinds of moments. And I thought the third quarter, I mean, they were in control of the game already, you know, coming out of halftime, right? And it was just, we're going to accelerate to sixth gear. You're not going to be able to keep up with us. And anytime you make a mistake, we are going to make you pay for it in the worst way possible, right? It's like, Luka turnover goes the other way, Steph Curry three. Luka turnover goes the other way, and I think it's like a dunk, like in a back-to-back possessions there. And at that moment, it's like, if your shoulders don't slump, if you're the Mavericks, there's at least the thought in your head of, like, we're not winning this game. This is over already, you know, even though there's still, like, you know, 20 plus minutes left in that ball game. And it did feel a lot like 2015, 2016, 2017. I mean, this team's ceiling is not nearly as high as peak Warriors, right? And their baseline is much shakier, as we saw in that Memphis series, than sort of the best versions of the Warriors. But this team is really good. I mean, they're still really, really good. And their defensive intensity and their just general approach to Luka was smart. I mean, make him work, try to tire him out. You know, try to make sure that Steph doesn't get isolated. Protect Steph if you're able to. Defend without fouling. Take advantage of turnovers. I mean, all that stuff, I'm sure, is what Kerr talks about in the pregame speech. And just to watch it all come together, I mean, he had to be just absolutely thrilled by that. The other thing I'd point out, too, though, is your defense is going to look amazing when Dallas shoots that poorly. They are such a high-variance team in terms of their three-pointers. I mean, number one in three-point attempts in this postseason by a pretty comfortable margin. And it goes back to the home road splits. Like, I haven't checked the numbers, but I imagine their supporting guys shoot an awful lot better at home than they do on the road. And a lot of those guys have never been on that big of a stage, right? And I don't think they looked fully shook, but like Jalen Brunson, pretty invisible. Dorian Finney-Smith, a guy who I absolutely love, and I want to see him. Let's start a campaign, Danny. Let's get him on the USA Basketball's World Cup team, or even potentially the Olympic team. It's just like that designated stopper guy. They always have one of those. I would love to see him in that particular role. Maybe we could get a Luka versus Dorian Finney-Smith, like, international showdown, you know, teammates at some point in the future. But he was terrible in game one. You know, it's a guy I want to root for, but he was bad all around in game one. And some of their other guys just didn't seem like they were quite ready for the moment. So I think they're going to settle in. I definitely think those guys will play better and shoot better in game three. But as much as we like the LeBron comparisons for Luka, I think that, you know, peak LeBron, especially going against the Warriors, even if his teammates weren't shooting well, he would be able to do more every single night consistently than Luka was able to do in game one. I just thought it was kind of like a C game from Luka, you know, not his best effort by any stretch. And you combine that with the lack of shooting, and, you know, and Dallas just didn't really stand a chance. So that's no knock on Luka. Look, he's 23 years old. It's amazing that he's on this stage. He has a real chance to win a title if they're able to kind of turn this series around. And he's definitely, you know, right on schedule for everybody who called him like a basketball prodigy coming into the league. But I think that if you're going to beat the Warriors, sometimes like your one-man band approach, you know, when you're built like the Mavericks are, like, that guy's baseline needs to be higher than Luka's was in game one.
2 points kind of on that. One, the Dallas shooting is a very fair point to make, especially in the first half. So Dallas was 7 of 29, and most of those looks were wide open catch and shoot. And it was, you know.
Oh, and it was, well, wasn't it 3 for 16 in the first quarter? And they had
Something like that. Yeah, it was. Let me pull it up. It was 3 for 19 in the first quarter.
Oh, 19. Sheesh. Well, and they had that one possession. They had 3 three-point attempts. I thought all of them were clean looks, and they just missed 3 in a row. And it's like, come on, guys. Like, you're not going to beat the Warriors at Chase if you're doing this.
And then the other one is a parallel between this series and the other, and also, like, the success that some of these teams, especially the Celtics, had in the previous round, is part of the reason why having multiple high-level defenders is really valuable is what it allows you to do for, like, a driving player. So we saw this in a Chase Center on Wednesday night, where Luka would drive and Andrew Wiggins would make it hard on him. He's, you know, trying to get by there. And then either Draymond Green or Kevon Looney, or sometimes both, are waiting there around the basket. And so it's not just what Luka, one of the things he did so well against the Suns is see when DeAndre Ayton is at the top of the key guarding Kleba or somebody else, attack, and all you have to do is beat one guy. You get downhill, and if they overreact, then you're getting an open corner three or open wherever you want it, or you're getting a layup or dunk. And we saw Luka do all of those things during the Suns series. And part of that is due to the personnel. And I mean, Jay Crowder is a good defender. He's just not good in that kind of backline role. And it requires a lot of your help communication. And early in the series, I thought like Devin Booker was pulling off the corner too early. And like we saw that in the Boston series, where Boston Bucks, where Drew Holiday is, you know, in the times he got by his man. And then all of a sudden Al Horford's there. Or I mean, Giannis was doing that. And the ability to have a second line defender, it makes all of it better, because it also means that the first defender can be a little bit more aggressive because they know they have something behind them.
Yeah, look, I mean, if Wiggins starts to get into serious foul trouble against Luka, which could happen at some point in the series, I do think the entire approach is going to look less effective than it did in game one. I mean, there's just going to be probably some of those moments, right? But if he's staying out of foul trouble and he's playing just good, solid textbook defense, stay in front of Luka, don't jump on his pump fakes, hound him up and down the court like you mentioned earlier, and then you've got Draymond you know, lurking in the back, and you've got a whole bunch of guys who play hard and together on the backside to rotate and contest shots, like, that's the exact personnel that you want to have to match up with Dallas's setup. And, you know, it's interesting to me, the frontline matchups in this series, right? Because, you know, you look at Dallas versus Phoenix, like, I felt like Ayton, you know, that's an issue. That's a hiccup when he's got to deal with these spread fives and, you know, he's getting called into all sorts of stuff away from the basket. I don't feel like he's, you know, some slow-footed cement block center, right? But still, he's getting tested in those spots. When Golden State goes to the smaller looks, like, they're going to be able to hang, you know, if you're bringing in Porter or whoever else around Draymond, like, they're going to be able to hang no problem, you know, kind of no matter how small Dallas wants to go. I mean, they're just a better matchup personnel-wise, and it was just kind of a hole for Phoenix at that four spot. spot of like, who can you play as a center? And they just kind of didn't figure it out. And flip it around, I feel like Golden State was so much more comfortable attacking Dallas's front line than they were against Memphis's front line in the second round. Like, Jaren Jackson Jr. got into an awful lot of foul trouble, but he also caused an awful lot of issues for Golden State just because he's that air traffic control type defender in the back, flying around, contesting shots, super long, cleaning the glass. Once they got Adams back, you know, his physicality gave Golden State some issues in a couple of those games as well for Memphis. And then just even their wing length, you know, I thought and size bothered Golden State a little bit more.
Like, Memphis was just flying all around the floor. Their hands were everywhere. And Dallas will get better. They improved in that respect over the course of the Phoenix series. But you felt Memphis a lot more defensively. Like, as somebody who was who's been at every Chase Center game, Memphis was more present defensively in those games than the Mavericks were last night.
Well, no question about it. Just, you know, imagine you're Jordan Poole, you're Steph Curry, and like you turn the corner. Do you want to turn the corner and look at Maxey, or do you want to turn the corner and look at Jaren Jackson Jr. and Steven Adams? You know, it's like a no-brainer. And I just thought that Golden State, you know, with all their cuts and with all their, you know, stuff going towards the basket, their paint points last night, they just felt much freer to me than they did in that second round. And Steph made a comment along those lines that kind of Memphis maybe like scrambled them a little bit or like threw off their offense, for some stretches during the second round. We could definitely see them kind of, you know, overthinking, getting into some of the turnover issues, you know, maybe settling for not the best shots. And I think that they match up better offensively against Dallas to me than they did against Memphis. I don't know if you feel the same.
I broadly do, but I think Dallas's defense will look better in time. But generally speaking, I mean, the Warriors have historically had more problems with athletic defenders than anything else. Like, that's the group thing, because there's an element of like, oh crap, they're just in this place than you anticipated. And Memphis, they were so aggressive, and they've been such a fantastic turnover team in some ways, especially without Ja on the floor. And so they were able to get on to some of the Warriors' pet stuff. And they're like, Nate and I were talking about it last night in person, where Steph Curry had a couple of just like looping passes that would have been, one of which just like eventually I think Wiggins got it or somebody else, and those would have been pick sixes against Memphis, because there's somebody's going to get there. And the other place, the last thing I want to say on game one of that series is Andrew Wiggins also deserves praise for making Luka work defensively. And the Warriors have a different structure to their offense. And I think the Mavericks were too afraid of putting Luka in some of the other defensive matchups. Klay and Steph will have some success at his expense. Like, that'll happen. But what Jason Kidd, the biggest mistake that I think he made, and as you mentioned, I think he's done a phenomenal job overall in these playoffs, is it's what are you willing to give up and what do you want to prevent? And I think they were so zealous preventing, especially in the first half, the Warriors getting open looks from three from their best guys, that they gave up 80, you know, the Warriors shot 81% on twos in the first half.
Yep.
And that, I think the risk calculus is a little bit different than that. And Luka's going to get cooked a couple times, and if that's going to be the case, but you can't give up those drives. And I expect to see, maybe it'll take until game three, but I think we'll see a different Dallas defensive philosophy. And that could look better in the series, even if it's very different than what they did against Phoenix.
Well, I mean, that is another aspect to the whole vintage throwback angle as well, right? I mean, how many times like those old Cavaliers teams would have two or three guys on Steph and somebody's peeling towards the paint wide open for a layup or a dunk, right? Like, used to just see those like escape hatch guys that have success. And if Wiggins is, you know, whatever you want to call him, the third or the fourth option, and he's getting into situations where he's backing guys down in the paint, he's getting mismatches against Brunson, and he's, you know, tossing in turnarounds over the top of a smaller defender, or, you know, or if he's knocking down his wide open threes like he did early in that game, like, Golden State is going to be very, very difficult to beat in that situation, because their main guys are going to show up in the big moments. So Wiggins, to me, does feel like maybe the number one X factor remaining in these playoffs. I feel like if he plays well, Golden State's the favorite. I don't understand at all, by the way, some of these projection models saying Golden State was fourth coming into the conference finals. Like, you're the numbers guy, Danny. Make that make sense.
Oh, boy. I don't want to give short shrift to what Miami did in game one. And I mean, Boston, like, so we talked about the difference between these two games, is that Boston had everything go right for them in the first half. Jason Tatum was spectacular. And the Celtics' offense looked amazing. They were making tough shots, but they were also getting those, you know, Tatum's assists, five of which, like, many of them were alley-oops to Robert Williams and, like, some great finishes and everything else. And the shots they took, and a lot of the credit here goes to Miami's defense, were a lot tougher in that third quarter. That's why I thought it was kind of the the blueprint. And I talked about Jimmy Butler's defense before, but the possession game and the turnover game, as they are in seemingly every high-level NBA playoff contest, are going to be so central because Miami, both these teams, and we to their immense credit, they understood at the very outset, like, the best way we're going to get points is by running and just pushing off of rebounds, pushing off of steals, doing everything you can. But Miami, once they were able to get those through turnovers and steals, they were really cooking with gas.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, as these games unfold, like on Boston's offense, I really do feel like they miss Smart. I'll be the first to admit, when they trade Kemba with no like discernible plan for how to, you know, find a starting point guard, like true point guard, and when they go the Schroeder route and it doesn't work, and then they just cut bait with Schroeder, I still doubted, like, is Smart going to be able to kind of fill this role effectively for them as a connector, as a ball handler, bringing the ball up the court on offense, getting guys like Tatum and Brown into their spots, and you know, just keeping the ball moving around the perimeter. I just always viewed him as too shot happy, not the world's best decision maker, and just a little bit too erratic for my liking. And I think when you're, you know, looking at that game, like down the stretch when it starts to get away from Boston, like, it'll be very difficult for Tatum to just like have a one-man shootout and keep up with Miami, given how their offense is balanced and given what a high level Jimmy's playing at. And I just feel like they really miss Marcus Smart in that spot of like, all right, well, we have to generate open looks, we have to have good flow across an entire game. And that's what Smart has brought to the table, you know, throughout this postseason. Definitely did it against Milwaukee, and I, to be honest, pretty surprised. Like, he performed above my expectations. Obviously, you know what you're going to get defensively. You know what you're going to get rebounding, hustle-wise, and all that stuff, and flopping-wise as well. But,
sure.
The offensive impact for him, to me, was great in the second round and was missing in game one.
It was, and it's been so weird. You got to see some of it in the bubble. Like, the shifts in Derek White's confidence and aggressiveness as a shooter from year to year, from week to week, from game to game, are incredible. And he, you know, I mean, I'm sympathetic. He was, you know, had some bad misses in the first half of game one, and then just never really quite got there. And Miami also they got a clear understanding of kind of what routes they could jump, you know, kind of use a football analogy, and that worked a lot better for them. Okay, they know this is going to be handoff, or this is the way that pass is going to work, and get a hand there. You're not going to get a steal every time, but you could get a deflection, slow down their offense, make them work. And I mean, Boston only taking 15 shots from the field in that third quarter. Some of that was because Miami got a bunch of offensive rebounds and also forced a ton of turnovers and everything else. But like and they only made 2 of those 15, which was incredible.
Yeah. No, that's the sign of a disruptive defense, right? It's sort of like, remember that huge stretch, I think it was the second quarter of game 5, Grizzlies versus Warriors, where like the Warriors couldn't even get a shot up for like 4 or 5 minutes straight because they kept throwing the ball out of bounds. That's what a high-level disruptive defense with those guys who are getting up in your chest and just making you sweat, making you uncomfortable, which is sort of what Miami does. That's kind of been their trademark for years and years under Spo. That's how it shows through. It is, you know, just way too many turnovers, not enough field goal attempts, and very low field goal percentage.
Plenty more with Ben Golliver, but first a message from betonline.ag. Our partners at BetOnline continue to be the number one source for all your betting needs and sports information. Find all the latest odds, news, and sports developments, including this year's basketball playoffs, Major League Baseball scores, fights, and even next season's NFL futures. BetOnline is your continued source for all of your sports wagering needs, including live betting and, of course, your favorite Vegas casino and poker games. It is really easy to get started, so head to the website today or use your mobile device to sign up today and use our promo code CLNS50 to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Remember, that's CLNS50 for your 50% welcome bonus. Also tells them that you came from us, which we really appreciate. So check it out at BetOnline, where the game starts. When you're running through the different things that you've done over the last week, one of them was that you were in Chicago for the lottery and I believe the first section of the combine stuff. What was that experience like?
It was really fun. Well, I didn't actually do any of the combine stuff. I just basically got down to that draft lottery drawing room And, you know, it was so funny, Danny, that like the lead story that a number of people were there is like, just in case the Lakers pick jumps way up, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like the ultimate like schadenfreude of like failure because they're missing out on this huge asset. I mean, a whole bunch of people were sort of like there with the express purpose of like writing the Lakers take another L story, which I was not, but I thought it was funny that a lot of people did that. It obviously didn't come to pass that way. I don't know if it was a gigantic headline with Orlando winning the lottery, but it was funny to me because the guy they had in the draft lottery drawing room was basically their PR guy for the last 30 years, right? And so he has original ping pong balls from the Shaq draft, from the Chris Webber draft, from the Dwight Howard draft as his lucky charms. And then he's just like very eagerly chasing down the winning ping pong ball to kind of add to their collection of these number one picks. And then as soon as they let us out of this drawing room where everybody's sequestered and you don't get to have the phones and you know, you can't contact the outside world and everything else, he just makes a beeline for their front office. I mean, he's just so excited. Like, we did it. We won. He just wants to kind of join the party. And then like within 2 minutes, Danny, he had to just go back to his normal job of being a PR guy. And so he's like taking group photos of the front office celebrating and like Jamal Mosley. And then he's like coordinating the interviews for all the writers who are there to kind of talk to, you know, John Hammond and their front office guys, Jeff Weltman, in terms of like what they want to do going forward with this pick. And it was like this incredible roller coaster. I mean, I just can't imagine being like the head of PR for an NBA organization, especially one like Orlando, which has really had a pretty tough decade here. You have this amazing moment where luck shines on you. You're kind of like the center of attention, but then within 5 minutes, the story shifts and you have to kind of go back to your doing your day job. It was just one of those humorous situations that we see in the NBA. But that, I wanted
that,
to ask
that
you...
That leads me to a question just quickly before you ask me mine. What is the timeline for when you... So do you not get released from the room until the results have aired?
Correct. So what happens is they basically get everybody into the room about an hour before the draft show starts, right? And it takes typically 15 to 20 minutes for them to actually do the drawing. It's not a very long process, but they have very exact rules about how they do it. I mean, it's so specific that they want to have 20 seconds between each pull of the lottery balls, right? And the guy who counts the 20 seconds so that he won't be influenced by any other like variables of, you know, looking at people or eye contact or anything like that, he actually turns his back to the lottery ball machine with a stopwatch and counts out to 20. And when he reaches 20, he puts his hand up in the air as the signal to the guy who's pulling the ball. So they have all these little weird quirks to like make sure the process goes very specifically according to plan. But it doesn't take very long because you're just basically drawing four ping pong balls four times. And in this case, they actually had to do a fifth draw because Houston won twice and they only had one pick. So they had to kind of redo it. You know, you're done within 15 to 20 minutes. And so then now you have another about half an hour or so of time to kill. And everyone's, you know, just basically schmoozing. So everybody in the room knows who won. So we went up to talk to Joel Glass, the communications guy for the Magic, and ask him his story of, you know, what was his lucky charms and all that. You know, Sam Presti was in that room. And, you know, he was very open and having a great conversation with a number of writers just about the draft and how important it is for them. And could you make the process better and all these kinds of things. And so we're chatting, you know, for about a half an hour. And then they put the draft lottery broadcast on in the room so we can watch everybody what you see at home on television, right? And so it was just so funny to watch, you know, Sam, when he won the number two pick for OKC, he had a completely straight face. Like, he did not react at all with a complete stone face, right? But when he watched Nick Collison on stage win the number two pick, he started laughing and clapping, like, huge smile on his face because he was, like, you know, getting the secondhand experience of watching Nick Collison's happiness. So it's just very funny, these little psychological things of how this plays out. And then as soon as Mark Tatum reveals the number one pick, they open up the door, and then we can kind of, like, rush over to the adjacent ballroom where the draft lottery drawing where the broadcast was taking place. And so the Magic PR guy, he was the first one out the door. Like, he just, you know, shot out of a cannon, wanted to go and meet up with their group. And they had a nice little celebration right by the stage. And, you know, guys like Chet Holmgren and some of their prospects are just sort of milling around. You see a number of the big agents are just in that room, kind of hanging out afterwards. And, you know, it was, you know, it's just one of the weirdest things the NBA does, frankly. You know, people are writing down the lottery drawing numbers by hand on this billboard. And it's just, you know, it's a goofy scene. But
that's awesome.
The question I had for you on Orlando. So you know, they got kind of a real choice here at number one. It's not like, you know, the Zion draft or the LeBron draft or even the Dwight Howard draft or the Shaq draft, right, where there's going to be some back and forth about what you do. So on the one hand with Chet, their front office loves length, right? Like they're the Giannis guys who drafted Giannis. You know, they always tend to go for the long athletic guys. That would seem to be possibly Chet. There's the Jalen Suggs connection, right, where they both are from Minnesota and both went to Gonzaga. But at the same time, like, not all of those long picks have worked. Like Mo Bamba, yeah, it was that a good decision or not? I don't know. Does that hang over the idea of, like, do you take another center there? And then you flip it around. And a player like Jabari Smith, I think some people would say, like, you know, much lower bust potential than Chet, right? They had a terrible offense last year. He would plug pretty naturally into what they're trying to do positionally. And so I was just wondering, like, do you, which way do you lean? Do you think it's going to be Chet? Do you think it's going to be Jabari? Do you think it's going to be somebody else at that number one spot? And do you think, like, their reputation for always wanting to get the longest guy will actually favor Chet, or could it come back to bite them because maybe they're nervous that, like, well, he might, you know, he might be great, but he also might have a downside. Are they going to get scared off of the downside? Because this isn't like drafting Giannis 15th where there's no pressure, right? This is the number one pick that you just waited 10 plus years to get. I mean, almost 20 since your last number one pick, but, you know, it's been a long time for them.
It has been a long time for them. And I think that there is a lot of pressure on the Magic to get it right. And there are real options. Now, I've started my draft work. I haven't actually watched Jabari Smith yet. I've watched my film. I just finished my film on Chet Holmgren today. And those questions are fair. I don't think they're going to they value length, but I think also the positional versatility, if Jabari Smith has that, I've heard a little bit about that, that could be compelling for them too, because the Magic are still trying to figure out everything else. For me, the more fascinating question is, on a related note, considering this draft class, is best available versus best fit. So let's say maybe it's due to how much they love length, or they just think he's the best player. The Magic think that Chet Holmgren is the best prospect in this draft. It just so happens that one of the brightest stars in the Magic system right now is Wendell Carter, who has had a very nice run so far. And they have power forward options, including, I mean, Franz Wagner can play both the three and the four, but I think personally of Franz Wagner as a natural four. And Jonathan Isaac's presumably coming back, you know, at some point. And they have a lot of other options, potentially. I mean, Bamba played a lot with Wendell last year and all these other things. And so the question becomes, at another point, if they think Chet Holmgren is the best, do they roll those dice of drafting somebody on the top of one of your best young players and putting that pressure? But I was just talking with somebody recently about the Cavs decision, and Kobe Altman made a bold step drafting Darius Garland the year after they drafted Colin Sexton. And that's why you bet on your board, is that if you think player X is better than player Y, unless you're going to pull a Danny Ainge, Markel Fultz, Jason Tatum move and bet on your board by moving down and saying these players are virtually the same to us and we're going to get all these other assets for it, you owe it to yourselves to take the player that you think is best, because that's the decision that you have, that you'll be able to live with. And saying this guy is overlapping, or he, you know, he doesn't fit exactly with what we're trying to do, it's like those things will shift in time. But if you think that this player is the best, and I'm not sure that they'll think Chet is, like, I'm not using that to presuppose it, but it becomes a more stressful decision if that ends up being the case.
Yeah, so I actually think that you could play Chet at four alongside Wendell Carter Jr. And I think that would actually work out pretty well, just because Carter's a little bit sturdier. He can handle the more interior-minded assignments, and Chet can handle, he can cover more ground, be a good help defender, and, you know, switch and pick and rolls and all that. I think that would actually work out pretty well. I don't view that as like a hang up. You know, it's sort of, you mentioned Cleveland as an example. It's sort of like, you know, was the presence of Jared Allen, a potential all-star, going to hold them back from taking Mobley? The answer was no. Instead, they just wanted to build this gigantic front line that could just squash everybody. And Orlando's in a position to do the same thing. I mean, if you're going 3-4-5 with Jonathan Isaac, Chet, and Wendell Carter Jr., that could be a pretty good team pretty quick. You know,
yeah,
I mean, I don't know how long
Franz
it would take
Wagner's
them.
Franz Wagner's like 6'10 himself. Like, that's plenty. Right. That's plenty long too. And they also, like, you can kind of diversify your front court portfolio, which I think is going to happen either way. The top three guys, as you know, preliminarily, I'm seeing it, are all front court guys, and maybe Ivy can work his way into this conversation, and that is another question for another day. But I like both Smith, from what I know about him, and Chet Holmgren in Orlando, on the idea that they provide something different than they have, and there's star potential. And with Holmgren, you brought up, you know, playing in power forward. He primarily played power forward at Gonzaga, and that a lot of that was due to the presence and lack of defensive versatility of Drew Timmy, a wonderful player. That's just, you know, that's not what he does super well. And Holmgren also, his extreme skinniness can, he has these natural kind of like help instincts at the four, and it suited him well. I think part of that is just he has good defensive instincts and applied them at the four because that's the position he was playing. But you could see that, and you could see Wendell Carter being an important part of the rotation. There are a lot of different answers here, and like you've been brought up, like that's again why you go best player available, is because you can make it work, whether that's by playing those players together or by theoretically moving one of them down the line.
Yeah, to me, he's going to be a four, especially to start his NBA career. I look at it a little bit like young Anthony Davis or Evan Mobley, where like the main benefit of Chet right now is the defensive versatility and the help side and the shot blocking that you're getting, not necessarily like the on-ball low post defensive stuff. Like that's good too, but it's more about like let him rove, let him cover ground, and let him just kind of ooze talent. And that's sort of, you know, the blueprint for what they're trying to do. I do think if Orlando goes Jabari, and the idea is like, look, he fits as well. And what Jeff Weltman said to me was, look, we are going off of talent and character. You know, we do not care about fit. So he's sort of, you know, telegraphing exactly what you were describing. But if they decide, look, Jabari's got really no red flags, he's going to be a big time scorer, he's going to fit in, you know, defensive wise and be a real versatile defender. And again, you could put these crazy lineups out with him and Isaac and Wagner, and that's an awful lot of length as well. If they go that direction, I definitely think OKC's taking Chet at two, right? I mean, everybody's going to point to the Poku thing of like, well, you know, we know, you know, Sam Presti's not afraid to like, you know, go for like a unique body type or whatever else. I just think that Chet was so smart to go to Gonzaga and go to a basketball program that was only about basketball. You know, it's in a small place, like there's no distractions. He is somebody who seems to me to be pretty obsessed with the sport after watching him a little bit during the NCAA tournament and the West Coast Conference tournament. Like, he just seems like ball is life for him. And even at the draft lottery yesterday, or a couple days ago, I should say, he didn't want to leave. Like, he was just hanging out, you know, like he didn't have any other place, you know, better place to go, quote unquote. And sometimes you see guys come in with their entourages, and they, you know, they run out of there because, you know, presumably they got someplace to go celebrate, or who knows. Chet was just hanging out, having a good time, and so to me, like, that's what OKC is all about. You know, it's the old story. It's about the dog food factories that Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook used to, like, you know, go to the practice facility across the street from, and, you know, wake up super early. It's that college program like mentality. I think OKC would just be a natural fit from a personality wise. And it would also help keep some of the pressure off of Chet as he develops. I think that this team breakdown actually broke perfectly for Chet, because if he goes to either Orlando or Oklahoma City, you're not getting that big market glare, right? Like, you're going to have all of basketball Twitter following your every move. But if you get into a lot of foul trouble as a young big, if people push you around, if you get posterized, if there's some tough moments in the first couple of years as your body starts to mature a little bit and you get used to the pro game, you're not going to be at Madison Square Garden dealing with that, right? Like, you're not going to be in some of these other just higher pressure environments. And it's sort of like the Markelle Fultz thing with Orlando, where it was a natural place for him to go have a second chapter because you could just do it away from all the attention and the scrutiny. I think that either one of those places could be really good incubators for a guy in Chet who I love. I really like his long-term potential, but I do think it's going to take him a while to get there, and I think either one of those spots could would be good landing places.
Those are all good points, and I will add in, there's also in both of those locales, and you could add Houston here as well, not an immediate pressure to be dominant early. And if it ends up taking Holmgren some time, Orlando is not, if they can make the playoffs, great, but they're not trying to push the accelerator right now. They could wait a year or two. Sam Presti's
they've got
Go ahead.
I was just, no, they've got nothing but time. I mean, like they, you know, they just blew it up in 2021, Orlando did. And, you know, the Thunder just blew it up after the bubble, right? So they both view themselves as being very early in the stage of that rebuilding program. So I totally agree.
And they also both have enough surrounding talent that, like, so playing along with, if Holmgren goes to OKC with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Josh Giddey and some of the other things they're building, and he can help give both of those teams not only a defensive identity. Oklahoma City, I think they've actually played above their talent level on defense the last couple of years. I really like Mark Daigneault as a coach. And adding somebody like Holmgren who can deter shots and can also key them in transition could be make them could shift kind of the way we think about the Thunder. And it's just, it could be a similar story with the Magic as well. I wanted to close, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but like, I mean, I've started doing offseason preview work for The Athletic and for Dunked On. And if I were applying kind of the fundamentals of this year to where I was, where the league was 10 years ago, I would say like, this is in line for a quiet offseason. You have a pretty weak free agent class. You have very few teams with cap space. A couple of them are compelling, but very few teams with cap space. You have a lot of star talent under long-term contract, and a lot of them, almost all of them, are in competitive situations. Like the best of the best, maybe they weren't this year or they were hurt or something else, but like, you know, they should be in the mix. Like, I think that's a fair way of putting it. We'll see with some of them. But normally speaking, you would say, okay, that's going to lead to a relatively calm offseason. However, relatively calm offseasons don't seem like they ever happen in the NBA anymore.
Yeah, that's a thing of the past. I think the number one factor why is desperate superstars, Danny. You know, look at LeBron, look at Kevin Durant, and look at Joel Embiid. All three of those guys are 10 out of 10 desperate right now to win. You know, the Lakers, nightmare season. LeBron's been home forever. He's so bored, he's doing Twitter Q&As like three times a week. You know, it's like, all right, we get it. Like, you haven't played basketball in way too long. Kevin Durant, the season was so tough with Kyrie Irving that he hopped on a jet and went as far away from Brooklyn as possible to go watch basketball in Greece because he had to get away from the end of their season, which was a complete and utter disaster. And then the Philadelphia 76ers, they might face more pressure than anybody. You know, Embiid is, as I wrote last week, you know, he was pitched as the next Shaq, like this, you know, big man who's going to be the face of the sport, take over the entire league, dominate, win all these MVPs. He's turned into the next Barkley. You know, he can't get to the conference finals. He can't get over the hump and win the MVP award. The Philadelphia City Council, I should say, awarded him the most valuable Philadelphian made-up award because they felt so bad for him. I'm sorry, that's not going to make him feel better. Like, that's only going to make it worse. It's going to only make it more annoying that he hasn't gotten the sort of validation after eight seasons that he's been seeking, right? And so I think all those teams have explosive potential. If I was Brooklyn, I would think long and hard about moving on from the Kyrie Irving experience. I would just want to be out of the Kyrie business. It's not worth it. You know, the juice is not worth the squeeze, as they say. If I was the Lakers, obviously you want to trade Russell Westbrook come hell or high water. And if you're the 76ers, you have a crazy difficult decision. What do you do with James Harden? And can you really pitch that to Embiid as the number two guy who's going to help get him over the hump when you've got all these other contenders in the East now that are better built for the playoffs than the Sixers are? And they're probably not going to have Danny Green next year because of that horrific injury that he had right at the, you know, in the final game of the season. So to me, the pressure is on all three of those organizations to do something drastic. And as we saw with the Lakers trade for Westbrook last year, doing something drastic does not mean something good necessarily.
Right.
Like, it can be weird and horrible. It can blow up in your face.
And the other X factor in this offseason, and this will parallel some of the other ones we've seen, I was thinking a little bit about 2020, is not super megastars, but like kind of the next tier down, agitating. And so what happens with Bradley Beal? It looks like Damian Lillard's going to stay in Portland and see where this thing goes. And that's what he wants to do. He has earned the right to choose his future. And if that's in Portland, great. And those two players are central to that. Donovan Mitchell, he's too far away from free agency to necessarily do it. But generally speaking, the arc of the NBA is if a player really, really wants out, unless they're Eric Gordon in New Orleans all those years ago, they're going to get their way. And I...
Well, at the very least, he's got to do a him or me thing, right, with Rudy?
Yeah, like, Danny Ainge might be like, that's... Like, you don't need to even say it. Like, I have a different theory of this team. I don't... That's generally the way things have worked with Danny Ainge in the past. But, so that's... And those two things could sync together, the desperate kind of major stars and major markets and these maybe lower level... I mean, what level of player Bradley Beal is next year is a big looming question that I don't have a good answer to. And some of those might sync up, some of them might not, because those teams are pretty asset poor. You know, like if Donovan Mitchell says, I want to be somewhere else, I don't see the Lakers, the Brooklyn Nets, the Philadelphia 76ers having enough juice to make it happen. But we'll see some reshuffling. And sometimes when things look more stable, the reshuffling actually gets more severe because it has to come from somewhere.
Absolutely. And a couple other teams just to mention, you know, Phoenix, that seemed awful combustive, you know, at the end of the season there. The eight in question looms. Chris Paul, like, what's going on there? Has he reached a desperation stage where he would want to look for something else, or they might want to go a different direction because of how much money he makes? I don't know. I mean, there's strong reasons to try to run it back, but it's very difficult to talk yourself into that being another finals team next year if you don't have some sort of a major shakeup. And, you know, we can always doubt whether they're going to want to spend the money, you know, with that group. And the other team is Chicago with Zach LaVine. I mean, of all the like more traditional, like a guy has a big free agency decision, he's going to get some interest. And I feel like that might be the one this year that's, you know, less about guys under contract agitating and more just about like, well, was this the right spot for him? Is Chicago willing to pay him every last dollar? What does their future look like if they do? Would they be better off trying to do something else? You know, it'll probably get resolved in a straightforward fashion. He'll make a lot of money and they'll go forward and try to build on a step forward type season like they had last year. But it's no guarantee. And we'll have to see.
Yeah. And in that front, the other element that will be a huge part of the 22 offseason are extensions for guys that aren't pending free agents. And so what teams line up their futures? What situations are kind of looming into next year? I have a piece that's coming out in The Athletic about this front very soon. And some part of the reason why that's going to be important is that a lot of these teams don't have a ton of flexibility and they can't afford to just let their player walk. And so will some of these teams either pony up a little bit just to secure it, or will the players take a little bit less because they don't want to take the risk of being in a walk year? And how much uncertainty can these franchises bear? Is it going to be a circumstance where it's like, where it seems like it's a looming thing over it, and the extension system is mostly fixed? The situation that led to Kevin Durant becoming an unrestricted free agent in 16, that's not going to repeat because star players are generally taken care of, but that doesn't mean everybody is.
Yeah, last team to mention on my end, Portland, you know, sure. From a desperation standpoint, they've been telegraphing like, we're trying to be in the mix. You know, Joe Cronin wants to make a signature move. He tore everything down, now he needs to build it back up. So I think that they're going to try to be movers and shakers. I was going to ask you real quick on the extensions. I mean, so many of these get done now for prominent players early. How do you feel just as like, you know, an observer, like a media member, like, do you like the, the explosion of extensions? Or did you prefer the previous model where we got more guys actually getting to free agency and, you know, doing the tours of different cities where they're, you know, putting up pictures of you with the jersey, you know, like the Carmelo Anthony tours and all that? I feel like some of the extensions has just taken a little bit out of fun out of it. I get why they exist, but just like as a pure observer, I kind of enjoyed like what teams would try to just get like 90 million in cap space and just go crazy. And we don't really see that anymore, you know?
For purely selfish reasons, I miss the players hitting unrestricted free agency. It was a lot of fun. It also led to plenty of content on my end. I thought that, and because you would also get to see the nature of like what a player wants. I wrote this piece years ago for a Real GM called The Third Contract. And it was about how, because in those days, I mean, this is still mostly true, the first contract is locked in by the rookie scale if it's a first round pick. The second is virtually for high-end players locked in because the extension system and everything else. And the third is when you find out what a player really wants. And that could be like, that was when LeBron went to Miami. That's when Kevin Durant went to the Warriors and everything else. And there are lower end players. That's when Jeremy Grant went to the Pistons instead of going with the Nuggets. And we're seeing more of that with extensions. I'm happy for players because the biggest thing that does is it mitigates a ton of risk for them, and I fully support that. I think that's, you know, great for them. If that's what they want to do, awesome. And, you know, and the level of stability that Giannis gave the Bucks in 2020/21 by signing that extension, I think that was an important part of them winning the championship that year. And, you know, that and you could say that's how they got Jrue Holiday, was that he, you know, that they were desperate enough to do it, but then it did end up happening. They did win the championship. But for my own enjoyment, yeah, I liked it when they were, when players got out there. And also, it opened up the universe a little bit more. So a lot of teams were going to end up striking out and we're going to do that. But then that also opened up other possibilities. And so you could see players kind of change teams in a different sort. And like Nate and I were just doing our offseason preview for the Sixers, and we were talking about how few places there are that really make sense in a Tobias Harris trade. And if there were more teams with cap space, if there were more teams with flexibility, it would still be hard because he's incredibly overpaid. But there's less flexibility around the league. So that means you need more complicated stuff. However, and I'll end with this, there is still enough creativity within front offices, and I think generally partially because they have more personnel and because the league has gotten more proactive over the years, that just because there's less flexibility doesn't mean there's zero. And Miami getting Kyle Lowry is a fantastic example of that. Like, they, being able to pull that off and being able to get PJ Tucker while staying under the hard cap was a bit of mastery, and Andy Ellsberg is the best in the business at that wizardry, but you can still make things happen. You just have to.
For sure. Well, and the logjam effect that you're talking about with teams not having the flexibility and all that, that is what, you know, that's a bad combination when teams get desperate and when superstars get desperate, right? Because that's when you, when your only out is to give up 3 or 4 or 5 years of your draft picks going forward and swaps and all that stuff. We're already seeing that come back to bite a few very prominent teams. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if we see a team or two this summer say, well, look, this is our only option. You know, if we need to get Joel Embiid help, or if we need to get player X help, the only thing we can do, because we don't have the ability to sign anybody outright and we don't have a lot of young players to kind of sweeten things up, the only thing we can do is mortgage our future. And the precedent has been set. You know, I expect to kind of see it again, frankly. And then we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, we will see. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on, my friend.
Thanks, Danny. Great to chat, man. Take care.
Thanks again to Ben Golver for taking the time to come on. You can read his work at the Washington Post, where he is a national NBA writer. You can also read his book, Bubble Ball, and you can also listen to the Greatest of All Talk podcast that he does with Andrew Sharp, which is really great. And if you don't already, you can follow him on Twitter at Ben Golliver, BenGolliver. He's right. He said at the intro, it'd been a while. He and I talk sometimes not on the pod, but it was good to do so and to get his perspective. And I love the story on what it's like to be in the room at the lottery. It's an experience I've never had, but I think would be a lot of fun. And the dynamics with, you know, knowing the result but not getting to tell anybody and all that would be pretty cool. And then you get to watch the show knowing what happens when nobody else does. That's a different experience than a lot of us are ever going to have. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode, really whatever podcast player you use. And that's great for Real GM Radio because it's never going to come out on a specific day of the week. You can't get into a habit with it because it's when I have time, it's when my guest has time. And so you can do that, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, really wherever. You can also help other people find the show by leaving a rating or review in that aforementioned podcast player, or telling people on social media. That can be a big help too. And then the single most important thing for this show and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors. For us, that is Bet Online. You can go there and use that CLNS50 code for a 50% welcome bonus. And then, of course, tells them that you came from us. So really do appreciate that. You can also check out my other work. Nate Duncan and I are doing Dunked On and Dunked On Prime. Lots of content right now because not only are we talking about all the playoff games, but also starting our off-season work, including off-season previews. We recorded 3 of those on Thursday. And then also, I've started my draft prep. I think Nate's starting pretty soon. So we'll get into that over the next month as well, as, you know, Ben and I talked about the lottery. And on top of that, we are doing live shows now again on Playback, which is this really cool new platform. We'll tweet it out each time we do it. We're going to be doing primarily the Eastern Conference games in the early going because Nate and I are attending Warriors-Mavs games at Chase Center. But then we will be doing more throughout in the other series and then the NBA Finals. And we love it because it's a single screen experience. you log in with your streaming and cable provider, and that means you can watch the game and listen to us in the same thing. You don't have to sync up. There's nothing else like that. It's just you're seeing it, we're seeing it, we're calling the game for you. It's so much fun, and we have a great discussion section. We answer questions during stoppages and all that, and I really have enjoyed the experience. You can also check out my written work at The Athletic. Had that piece on Harden last week, and then I have one that's coming out probably in the next day or so on extend or trade. It's a concept that I've talked about a little bit, but I wanted to really flesh out. And I think it's being released as a single piece. I actually wrote it as a two-parter because it's over 3,000-4,000 words. But I think it's being released as one big old piece, which will be fun. And that should be out, I think, on Friday is the tentative publication timeline. It might get moved a little bit depending on what happens. And then Nate and I do Spotify Live on Tuesdays. Typically, that is at 6 Eastern, 3 Pacific. We take your questions. I think of it like a call-in radio show. We love doing that as well. If you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I'll try to reply. I do my best, but I admit that I'm not the greatest at that, and that's why, you know, it's feedback. It's you sending me things like, hey, this guest, or whatever else you want to do. And that is all for now. Oh, if I didn't say the address, it's DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com. I can't remember if I said it. I'm saying it now. So thank you so much for listening. Take care, and make it a great day.